Hello and welcome to Atlantic Brücke's Transatlantic Call. My name is Robin Fehrenbach. I am Atlantic Brücke's Head of Research. And on behalf of our entire team, I would like to welcome all of you to the 11th edition of this audio format. Today, our Transatlantic Call is entitled The El Paso Experience, a first test for new community policies. And it is my great pleasure and honor to introduce our special guest in today's call, Congresswoman Veronica Escobar. The Congresswoman is representing Texas' 16th congressional district in El Paso for the Democratic Party. She took office on January the 3rd of 2019 as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives after making history as the first woman elected to the seat and the first of two Latinas from Texas to serve in Congress. Congresswoman Escobar serves on the prestigious House Judiciary Committee as well as the House Armed Services Committee. She serves in leadership positions on both the Congressional Hispanic Caucus and the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Prior to joining Congress, she served on the governing body for El Paso County, first as a county commissioner and then as a county judge. Veronica Escobar, welcome and thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, well, hello, good evening, everyone. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me to participate in this call. Thank you for your interest in what's happening in El Paso, in my district. And I'd like to especially thank Atlantic Brücke for all their work. And thank you, finally, also for your patience in allowing us to reschedule. I know we had this call planned in December, but as you all read in the international press, we had an impeachment hearing that was going on, and as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, it was my duty and obligation to participate in those hearings. So I'm delighted to be on this call with you today, and thank you for the opportunity.
It's so great to have you with us, and we fully understand that we had to reschedule this due to what's going on in Washington, of course. And the moderator of today's call is Michael Wertz. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., where his work as member of the National Security Team focuses on the nexus of climate change, migration, and security, and emerging democracies, especially Turkey, Mexico, and Brazil. He has been a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and above, Michael Wertz is a board member of Atlantic Brücke. Welcome to the call, and with that, I would like to hand over to you, Michael. Let's start the conversation.
Thank you, Robin, and also thank you, Congresswoman, for making time. As Robin has mentioned, you are one of two Latinas that have been elected in Texas to the U.S. Congress for the first time in American history. Tell us a little bit about what the reactions were in El Paso, but also in Washington, because you are a trailblazer in many senses, but this is one of them.
You know, in El Paso, because we are a majority Hispanic community, about 85% of the El Paso community is Hispanic, and specifically Mexican, of Mexican descent, many of our local leaders are Hispanic. Although I will tell you, it did take a long time for us to get as many Hispanics elected and Latinos elected in El Paso, and it is really kind of a recent phenomenon. But I have the tremendous privilege of serving in local government for over a decade and have been very privileged to have tremendous support from the community throughout my political career. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really important to me is that young women, especially young Latinas, get to see women who look like them and sound like them with the same roots and the same background and heritage in positions of authority, because it allows them then to understand that they too can be at the leadership table and that they too can accomplish whatever they set their mind out to accomplishing. And with regard to here in Congress, you know, the 116th Congress, which was sworn in, I'm a member of that freshman class, we were sworn in a year ago. It is historically the most diverse and Congress that ever, and the largest number of women ever were sworn in. And it's long overdue, because I will tell you that this place, Washington and Congress in particular, really badly needs diversity of voices. And it's that diversity of voices and diversity of thought and backgrounds that really makes for a strong, healthy democracy. So we need more women. We need more women of color. You know, until we fully, adequately reflect the percentages in the country, only then will we truly be a diverse Congress.
Yeah, and I think it's important to mention for our European friends that there are almost 60 million Latinos in the United States. That number is going to grow to 100 by 2050, so it's absolutely an important political entity. But at the same time, you mentioned you are a freshman. This is your first term in Congress. But Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, has recently elevated you to the Democratic to a Democratic leadership position. How did you manage to become a senior person within your first 2 years in Congress, and how did that happen so quickly?
Well, you know, the freshman leadership position that that I was recently elected to, I was elected by my freshman colleagues. And the other leadership positions that I hold on the Hispanic caucus and the Progressive caucus, each one of those caucuses casts their vote for their elected leaders as well. I have been so incredibly fortunate to have received tremendous support from the Speaker and from my colleagues from the moment that I walked in. One of my goals early on was to build relationships. Because I've been in government and in politics long enough to understand the obvious, which is you don't get anything done without bringing people along with you. And you can't pass bills, you can't create change unless you have strong relationships with your colleagues. And many times, especially with colleagues who have divergent views from you. And so early on, I really did set out to try to get to know people and build those relationships. And the other component, though, that I think that made created a path for me was what was happening in El Paso in 2019. Mm-hmm. El Paso was at the epicenter of really horrific and abhorrent anti-immigrant policies coming from the Trump administration. And it was important to me that my colleagues see what was happening, that they bear witness to it, that they talk to people on the ground affected by it. And so my staff and I embarked on a series of what are called CODELs, and those are congressional delegation visits. We brought over a dozen CODELs to El Paso. We brought almost about 17% of Congress to El Paso in 2019. There was a point in time where it was like every other weekend almost, we had a group of members of Congress coming to El Paso, and we would, some of them we took over the border to Ciudad Juarez in Chihuahua, Mexico, so that they could meet with the refugees being denied entry into the U.S. We took them to hospitality centers in our community where we were caring for the refugees. I took them to the sites where the children who died in American custody were apprehended. And so through those visits and through all that travel to El Paso with my colleagues, we were able to get to know each other better. And I think they saw how hard I work for my community, how hard I work for the caucus, and how hard I work for the values that America was founded on. And so we found, you know, a lot of commonality, and we really bonded over many of those traumatic and difficult visits and circumstances.
Mm. And you obviously are referring to the attack that took place on August 3rd of last year at the Walmart Supercenter, where a young man that had driven several hundred miles to El Paso has killed 22 people, among them one German citizen, and it was the deadliest anti-Latino attack in recent U.S. history, because that young man published a pamphlet online in which he echoed a lot of the talking points that one can hear from the White House and other parts of the American political establishment when it comes to Latinos taking away American jobs, invading the country, and changing culture. Can you talk a little bit, as difficult as that might be, and share with us what your immediate thoughts were when you heard what happened? I understand that you were in El Paso at the time. You were on your way to a town hall meeting. How did that situation, as horrific as it was, play out on the ground?
Yeah, and you know, the shooting, the massacre that occurred in El Paso on August 3rd, this was after months and months and months of trauma in El Paso, where we had to face up against the anti-immigrant policies that were being executed in our community. So, you know, as the year progressed, our lawyers, our advocates, our faith-based community, all of our leaders, we were working day and night constantly trying to help the very vulnerable migrants who were coming into our community. And in many ways, we were showing the country exactly how we should be treating vulnerable refugees. And in the midst of all of that, on a day where I was having my town hall meeting, I was speaking with my constituents. It was a wonderful conversation, a discussion about many issues. My staff approached me in the middle of the meeting and told me there had been a shooting, and that there was still an active shooter out, and that law enforcement was urging everyone to quickly disperse and get home. And it was shocking, and you know, there's a moment of disbelief, of course, at first. And I didn't know how bad it could be. I didn't know if anyone was injured or dead. All we knew was that there was a shooter. So I urged my constituents to go home, to stay home, to be very careful, to be safe, and to get home immediately. And we terminated the meeting immediately. And I rushed back to my district office, because we were trying to gather as much information as possible, and the information was trickling in very, very slowly. But almost within the hour, we found out that a number of people had been killed. And you know, I will tell you, there's a tremendous amount of shock, especially when you hear about the number of people who were killed. But I knew in my, I felt in my gut and in my heart that it was driven by hatred. I just intuitively knew that that's what the inspiration was racism and hatred. And as you mentioned, as the gunman's screed was made public, and as the police confirmed that it was his, and as the gunman was apprehended and confessed that he drove to El Paso in order to slaughter Mexicans and immigrants, the shock didn't wear off for a long time. And then we had a press conference immediately that afternoon with the governor of the state of Texas. And I think what was even more deeply troubling for me was in that moment where we should have acknowledged as leaders what was fueling this gunman, our governor pointed to mental illness. And, you know, we know statistically that the mentally ill are more likely to be victims of crime, not perpetrators of crime. And it was a moment where I felt, to be honest with you, tremendous anger and frustration. And in that moment, a local reporter asked me a question about what I thought was driving it, because it was clear that, you know, that the governor was just going to try to avoid the issue of hatred and racism and xenophobia. And so I feel very grateful that I was asked the question, because I was able to confront head on what was driving the killer. And the killer admitted that it was a hatred for Mexicans and a hatred for immigrants. Mm-hmm. And it felt like in that moment, and it still is really difficult to discuss, but it felt like in that moment, the weight of the president's words and the weight of his horrific immigration policies had come to bear down on the community in the most violent and nightmarish way, and that was through the slaughter of innocent people. And as the month progressed, the month of August, you know, I spent most of my time at funerals or at bedsides in hospitals or in hospital waiting rooms. And as I learned the stories of the victims and their families and just struggled to come to grips with the injustice, you know, it made me realize how El Paso really was a very important community for the country because of what we've had to bear. But even in that really awful and painful period, the one thing that I can tell you that stands out to me more than anything is how proud I am of a community of goodwill and kindness and generosity and love and the way that we choose to treat one another. And it reminds me that in those terrible moments and in our most challenging moments, we make a choice. And we make a choice about how we're going to treat people. And El Paso, I think, has emerged as a shining example of the goodness that comes with choosing to care for people.
Thank you, Congresswoman. I mean, I appreciate how difficult this still must be for you to talk about these issues, but the authenticity of your raw emotions is really speaking to what your community has gone through. Taking a step back, did we underestimate the potential of white nationalism in Texas and in the United States at large? How did we get to this point that a place like El Paso becomes ground zero for such a horrific and complicated policy conversation?
You know, that's an excellent question, and I am still struggling with understanding how our country has allowed this point to emerge in our history. I mean, we are at a very, very low point and at a very dark place in American history right now. And we saw in Charleston when there were white nationalists and Nazis essentially carrying torches chanting, "Jews will not replace us," you know, that these are tests for our nation. And the people at the highest positions of authority, the people with the loudest voices, the people with the greatest bully pulpits have a profound obligation to lead us out of those dark moments and to use those dark moments as a turning point, where we can take our country in a better direction, in an appropriate direction, moving us away from racism and xenophobia and hatred and division. But what we've seen in America, unfortunately, over the last few years, is not just some of our most significant leaders, including the president and led by the president of the United States, not only have we seen them be derelict in their responsibility to lead us out of that darkness, but we have, in fact, seen them pull us deeper into that darkness. And the test now is for the American public. And that test is a test we're going to have to take during these elections in 2020. And we're going to have to take a long look at ourselves in the mirror as a country and ask ourselves if this is acceptable and if this is who we want to be. And, you know, elections are not won and lost organically. You know, you don't sit on the sidelines and hope for the best. You know, so everyone in America has a very important role to play in ensuring that we move away and move out of this darkness. But we have the biggest test yet when it comes to white nationalism, and when it comes to awful shadow of racism that we have in this country that is at one of its darkest moments. That big test is coming up for us this year.
Mm-hmm. And besides the need to change the political climate that we're living right now in the United States, there's also obviously the urgent matter of coming up with policy solutions and legislation to make sure that future mass shootings are hopefully prevented. What is your thinking now with a few months distance between the attacks in your hometown? And what is your thinking about the legislative part? How do we deal with gun control? Is the political context one that now allows for meaningful legislation? These are also questions that some of the our Atlantic Book members and leaders that are on this call have sent to us and we're eager to hear from you about.
Well, as you may know, the House of Representatives has passed bipartisan common sense gun violence prevention legislation. We even came back from our August recess early in order to pass more legislation. And we have been having those debates on the House floor. We've been passing bills through committee, and they've all landed on the Senate side, where we have one person, the Senate Majority Leader, one person, Mitch McConnell, preventing those pieces of legislation from being debated and preventing those pieces of legislation from being sent to the president's desk to be signed into law. And so we have the American public on our side, because poll after poll after poll has told us that the American public believes that there are common sense laws that can make the country and can make communities safer. And we've been responsive to that, and it's deeply frustrating that one person is able to hold up all of that legislation. I think this isn't, this, you know, I keep talking about this test that we have in America, but, you know, our job really and our challenge is to help Americans maintain hope that change can happen, but at the same time point out to them, but when you stay at home or when you sit out an election, here is the consequence. You know, and the consequence is we have people in positions of authority who are absolutely comfortable with ignoring the will of the American public. And so elections are really important, and they're really critical. And my hope is that the American public sees very clearly what happens when Democrats have been in charge, as we are in the House. We get the people's business done, and we do it in a common sense, bipartisan way. And I hope that they see the contrast with what happens when Republicans are in control, in that, you know, there's no desire to legislate. It's about essentially usurping the will of the American public. It's a very hard place to be, because, you know, as productive as we are, to see our legislation just essentially pile up on the desk of one person, it's disheartening. But we have to keep pushing. We have to keep educating the American public. We cannot allow the public to be complacent or to lose heart.
But you have a Republican mayor in El Paso. You have a Republican colleague in Congress in the district next door, Will Hurt, in Texas 23. How are your Republican local politicians and colleagues reacting, and what are they saying about the stalemate that they are seeing, which is mainly, as you have described, due to the Senate leadership of their own party?
Well, you know, that's what's been additionally frustrating to me. You know, my neighbor to the east, Will Hurd, who has recently announced that he is retiring from Congress. You know, he used to be someone that Democrats could count on to be a moderate voice and someone willing to cross the aisle to work together. But, you know, now that he has his sights set on what's going to happen to him after retirement, he's been pretty much in lockstep with the president. So we can't count on him to be bipartisan on many of these issues anymore, because he's got a different career path ahead of him. And you know, and the mayor of my community, who is a Republican, I believe he signed on to the U.S. Conference of Mayors call to Congress to pass common sense gun violence prevention legislation. Now, you know, he also, the Republican mayor in El Paso, he's got a very good relationship with our Republican governor, who has yet to do anything legislatively on gun violence prevention. I would argue that my Republican mayor has really a lot more sway over our Republican governor. I don't know that he has chosen to use that influence, though.
Mm-hmm. And to just ask you about one more really controversial policy issue that has played out in your hometown as well, the United States government has sent U.S. troops to the U.S.-Mexican border. You are a member of the Armed Services Committee, as Robin has mentioned in his introduction. That committee is allocating the use of military funds and personnel. It was highly controversial after the president decided to mobilize U.S. troops to the U.S. border, because it was not clear to many that this was really a national emergency that warranted such action. What was your take on this situation, and what is the status quo right now along the border with regard to the U.S. military that by law is not really allowed to act within domestic environments in the United States?
You know, one of the biggest challenges that I have with my Republican colleagues and with many of their constituents who believe that sending troops or building a wall is good public policy, they have bought into the myth that asylum seekers or undocumented immigrants are a national security threat. And as leaders in Congress, especially those of us on the Armed Services Committee, you know, we need to recognize that a mother with a baby who is fleeing violence in Central America and arriving at our front doorstep, knocking on our door, seeking asylum, she is not a national security threat. She is not a threat to the safety and security of the United States of America. Yet we are treating her and her baby as though they are. And, you know, this challenge that we face, and I will tell you, I've been disappointed with my own party as well, because my own party over the years has bought into this idea that immigrants are a national security threat. Every country deals with migration. And as we begin to see the ravages of climate change become even more existential, we are going to see even more mass migration all over the globe. We cannot treat it as a national security threat. We have to think about the movement of people and the laws that govern that movement in a different way. And so when the president sends troops to the border, he is doing it not because there is truly a national security threat that we face. I mean, and believe me, I mean, I believe that we need to have secure borders, but I would argue that our border is secure. We have never at any point in our history spent as much money as we are spending today on border security with diminishing returns. But there's a smart way to do it, and there's a political way to do it. And the president has chosen the political path, the path that will feed on the fears of his supporters, the path that will continue to divide us, a path that is wasteful of resources, and a path that not only doesn't make us safer, I would argue it makes us less safe. And so, you know, there was just an announcement yesterday that the president intends on pulling even more money out of the recently approved budget for building more wall. That wall is not going to fundamentally change the fact that Central American refugees and Mexican refugees and Cuban refugees are arriving at our front door. It's not going to change it at all. Not only are we not any closer to a solution, but we have squandered important resources that are intended to make us safe and go to national defense. So, you know, I voted against the appropriations bill because the president was allowed to move money in this way. It was a protest vote. You know, I was in the minority, but I will continue to use my voice to try to educate my colleagues and my community, and in cases like this, to share my experience with the international community as well.
That sounds great. Let me ask you one last question, Congresswoman, because we know you have a very, very busy schedule. Traditionally, the Latino community in the United States and also Latino political representatives have not been overly engaged in national security policy, international affairs, and even much less in the transatlantic arena. But you're not only a member of the Armed Services Committee, you are also scheduled to visit Germany a little over a month from now at the Munich Security Conference. And very interestingly, you have invited the co-chair of the German Green Party, Robert Habeck, who is one of the most popular politicians right now in Germany, to visit you in El Paso. And you'll actually spend Saturday next week a good chunk of time with him in your hometown. What are you hoping will his main takeaways be when he visits El Paso for a day and a half and then flies back home to Berlin and talks about his experiences at the U.S.-Mexico border?
And you're right. We have not seen enough Latinos in this space as I would like, and it's a space that I want to be a part of and hopefully one day be a leader in. And I'm very excited about the Munich Security Conference, very excited about next week's visit. You know, for as far apart as we are and far away from one another as we are, these are shared experiences, and I think I have a lot to learn from my German counterparts, and I think you all have a lot to learn from us as well. And I think we grow as leaders, as policymakers, as people on this planet when we share those experiences and we look to one another for support and for solutions. And what's important to me about the visit for next week is that, as I mentioned just a couple moments ago, I believe we are going to continue to see migration occurring across the globe at unprecedented levels. And we have to come together to address root causes. One of those root causes, obviously, is climate change, root causes such as poverty. And at the same time, we have to educate our communities, because cynical politicians will use migration as a tool for fear. And we have to combat that cynicism and that division with good solutions and with understanding what's happening. And so I hope to build a bridge of greater understanding, a bridge of solutions and ideas together. And I hope that this is the beginning of more meaningful and continued and significant conversations.
Congresswoman, thank you very much. And let me hand it over to Robin to close our session.
Thank you so much, dear Veronica Escobar, for having shared your insights, which were sincerely emotional and authentic. You really have to stress this at this point, and your expertise related to this highly relevant topic. We are very glad at Atlantic Brücke that we were able to discuss this specific topic with one of the best leaders and figures in this field. So thank you so much once again.
My pleasure, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity and for everyone who took the time to participate in this call. Thank you.
I would also like to thank you, dear Maike Wertz, for your outstanding moderation of our call. Thanks again.
Great pleasure, and hope to see you all soon.
Great, and of course I want to thank the audience for joining this transatlantic call, and with that, have a good day in the U.S. and a nice evening in Europe. Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.